So welcome to today's podcast on the WikiLeaks Vault 7 CIA hacking dump and what it means to you. My name is Chris Sullivan. I am the CISO and CTO for Core Security, and I'm joined today by a couple of members of Core Labs. First, we have Mr. Willis McDonald. Willis is a senior threat researcher, and he's a bit of an interesting guy because there are parts of the dump, specifically the redacted parts, that he was not allowed to review because he may or may not have been too close to them in a prior life. We also have Mr. Bobby Kuzma. Bobby is a CISSP, an HCISPP, and a certified cyber forensic professional. Bobby's also an interesting guy. His actual title in the core security HR system is Sorcerer, and this may or may not be because our HR system might have been hacked. So with that, let's get started on today's discussion.
Yeah. So Christmas came a little bit early this year and gave us probably one of our best insights ever into an actual government-funded and sponsored offensive security operation. That's probably the best way to put what we found. It really well describes both the product management process, the development process and environment, a lot of great do's and don'ts for how to maintain appropriate security on the payloads that are being deployed. But there weren't a lot of surprises. The CIA is doing their job. Spies are going to spy. And they're the type of exploits and technologies that we would expect an intelligence agency to be leveraging when their focus is on human intelligence.
Well, at least you would hope they would be using these types of tools and following these types of procedures, you know, in their daily work in order to, get our worth out of our tax money.
And, you know, there's some things that are common in almost every development shop that I've come across. The not liking the version control software that's being used seems to be typical. The step-by-step guides for how to set up a dev workstation. Basically the product requirements and user stories for the different tools that they're developing for our intelligence officers to use. They put a lot of effort into user experience and making the end products easy for non-technical intelligence officers to be able to leverage. And that's kind of refreshing that they're building these tools to be readily taken advantage of by a number of not necessarily technical intelligence officers, which improves bang for the buck. And because of that focus, it kind of hits close to home for those of us here at Core, because we put a lot of effort into our own penetration testing and hacking products to make them easy to use.
I mean, just like our user base, you know, you're talking regular civilian workers as well as members of the military from a diverse, backgrounds, from people who came from one work role where they may have been fixing airplanes or something else to, you know, a guy who's been doing this type of work for his whole career in the military as well as a civilian worker.
And one of the things that was really interesting for me going through this is, from a scoping perspective, almost everything is oriented around physical compromise of electronic devices. It's not a lot of remote exploits. Almost all of this required laying hands on the target at some point in order to drop the implant.
Which goes into like the CIA's role as opposed to the NSA, where, you know, their roles are generally close contact, you know, human type operations where they're right there with the individual they're, you know, trying to target.
Yeah. Why bother dropping a bug in a black bag job when you can pop their TV and turn it into a bug?
Right. Pop the TV in a hotel room or something like that and start collecting your audio.
So there's a lot of buzz. Was a lot of buzz about, oh my God, the government's watching everything we do. This is not that, right?
There's no evidence in the documents that have been leaked so far that these programs were or even could be deployed in any kind of mass sense, like the NSA's capabilities were deployed. This is all very specifically targeted. There's a lot of individual effort required for actually popping the targets in the case of these tools. So this is not something that ever would be, even in George Orwell's worst nightmare, ever be deployed widespread against civilian populations.
So did you see any evidence that they were deploying any of these tools towards like citizens of the United States, or?
There were no direct indications that I found when reviewing this that this was being deployed inside of the U.S.'s borders. Now, certainly it could theoretically be deployed in that type of scenario, because a lot of the specific electronics that there are exploit programs developed around are used commonly in the U.S. as well as internationally, but that's just a matter of geographic distribution. There's zero evidence that any of these techniques have been deployed against U.S. targets, which properly is keeping within CIA's congressional remit.
Right, right. Which makes sense, because, I mean, if they were to deploy something like that, you know, they'd be breaking, one, their whole mission statement, two, they'd be breaking multiple laws, and it would be up to the actual guy using the tool to actually make that decision, because, you know, he would be the guy that ends up sitting in prison for a couple of years.
Or worse, sitting in front of a Senate Select Committee.
Right, right. I'd much rather sit in prison for a couple of years than sit in front of a committee.
So as a playbook for tradecraft, this is a pretty good volume of stuff. These specific exploits, which don't seem that dangerous, but they appear not to have been released yet. And those apparently, they're talking about what, releasing them to the vendors, which seems like a responsible approach.
Yeah, except Julian Assange is being his typical prima donna self and putting a lot of conditions on sharing those details. And realistically, there's enough information present in the descriptions of the exploits that most of the impacted vendors are able to at least figure out what portions of their product lines are impacted, and they should be able to figure out and correct, if they haven't already corrected, most of the exploitable vulnerabilities.
So I think Apple and Google have already come back and said, at least Apple and Google have come back and said, yeah, these are already fixed, right?
They've also more or less said, if you want to submit a thing, we've got a vuln disclosure process. We don't negotiate with terrorists.
Yeah, and most of those requirements that they put on there read more like, well, we're going to release these in the future, but we're going to make it really hard for you to comply with our demands to actually get a hold of these before we release the documents.
So when we, core security, when our researchers find vulnerabilities, right, we have a clean process for working with the vendors?
We do. Right. It's a coordinated disclosure process. So we start by making contact with the impacted vendor. And depending on what they do at that point, there's a couple of different branches that we go down. The ideal circumstance is that the vendor that's impacted has a well-documented vulnerability disclosure process or bug bounty program or similar, and we run through that. We'll work with them first off to quantify what's actually vulnerable to the issue, as well as to continue testing the fixes as they develop them. And then upon a mutually agreeable date, we make our announcement after they've pushed the patch into general availability for the target population. Now, if the vendor ignores us, we've got a pretty big hammer available in that we'll just announce it publicly and whatever happens, happens. But it's very, very rare that a vendor does not engage us at all, and we go through multiple defined attempts to get a hold of them, including calling them out through social media, attempting to contact the headquarters facility directly. We don't just make one attempt. We make a concerted effort over a period of months.
Right, and with the goal being that we get the information out there so that if adversaries have the same, you know, have the same vulnerability, can develop the same exploits, then you can prepare or protect against that, right?
So if there's no evidence of the vulnerability being exploited in the wild, we'll wait. But if there is evidence of exploitation in the wild and the vendor is dragging their feet, then our general stance is that the community is better off being informed of this so that they can take other countermeasures and implement other compensating controls. And normally, if there's evidence of active exploitation, the vendors responsible tend to be a little bit more ricky-tick about developing a fix, but that unfortunately is not always the case.
Yeah, so Willis, you were talking earlier about the idea that even though they haven't released the exploits, they've released enough information, and the difficult thing is really to find where the exploit would be or what type of exploit.
Right. I mean,
or
so
vulnerability rather.
So most of the information, doesn't necessarily give specifics on the vulnerability itself, but it points you close enough in the direction of where that vulnerability lies that I believe most vendors and, well, also attackers would be able to figure out where they need to look, because that's the hardest part of finding the vulnerability, is actually kind of narrowing down a scope of where the vulnerability lies.
Just knowing that there is a vulnerability present that's exploitable in
right.
this particular thing is a huge boon to the vulnerability researcher.
Right. Instead of having to take a shotgun approach, now they can actually zero in on where this vulnerability is, which saves
countless hours. Coming at a product from a vulnerability hunting standpoint with no knowledge of their being exploitable vulnerabilities in it prior, there's certain hotspots that we know to look for, like things like SNMP servers are ridiculously prone to parsing errors that lead to buffer overflows. But if we know for a fact that there's a vulnerability, that substantially makes our job a lot easier in tracking it down, rather than just going, well, we don't think there's one, but we're going to have to do more analysis on this just to make sure that our gut is correct on this. And, that's a knowing that it's there is a huge time savings for us.
So if you net it out, it's a bag, a playbook, if you will, or documentation for how to build a tradecraft program with plans and stuff like that, like Bobby, you mentioned. Details like don't use US-centric timestamps in part because of attribution, but in part just because that's just bad global software development.
We have this lovely concept called daylight savings time that doesn't make sense to anyone else in the universe, but you have to code around it. So a lot of infrastructure applications just use GMT as a matter of course. And, from a tradecraft standpoint, attribution is hard, and not leaving any easy hints that might allow attribution is just good sense.
Well, and not to mention, the CIA works worldwide, so you're interacting with other
software.
Well, you're interacting with other people who know GMT, and like Bobby said, don't know daylight savings time, so might as well use what everybody else uses.
Other people, other systems. So, I've been waiting to ask Willis this question because I want to watch his face. But what's Umbridge?
Umbridge? I have no idea.
Okay, so maybe Bobby can answer
Never heard
that
of it.
because Willis might be in a position where he's not allowed to answer that. So what is Umbridge?
So Umbridge, based on the dumps, is part of a concerted program to pick and choose techniques and algorithms from foreign malware to incorporate into our own to further make it harder to attribute. So, Russian crime family related malware tends to have a particular style in which it operates and communicates, and ditto with their state sponsored stuff. So Umbridge takes reverse engineered copies of that, puts them in an easy to use library, and allows us to build things that quack like Russian malware or Chinese malware or wherever stan malware to help avoid that attribution problem.
Yeah. So there's that. There's pieces and parts that they got from NSA, from the UK. So they actually lost a lot more than just CIA tradecraft.
Intelligence is a team sport.
Yeah. And it must be really hard to keep track of this stuff, right? Like nukes as a weapon system, okay, it's kind of hard to replicate. It's hard to move around this stuff once it's out in the wild.
Well, the fact that a now former NSA analyst walked out the door with several terabytes worth of secret or better information over the course of a decade plus tells us that even when you have really, really tight physical control, ones and zeros move a lot. And, you know, the saying goes, information wants to be free. It'll get free if you're not really, really careful.
Yeah. I mean, just look at the airport. Imagine, I mean, how much stuff gets through the airport, and then you're trying to check guys for thumb drives going through the turnstiles every day. That's, yeah, nearly impossible.
I had a bottle of water in my bag, and I this is about a year and a half ago, and I pulled it out of my bag when I went to unpack, and it was in Arabic. And I was like, wait a minute. So I had been in the Middle East, and then I went to England. I had to stay over in England for a week or so, and then I came back to the United States, and when I finally unpacked my bag, there was a full bottle of water. And so stuff gets through the airports, yeah.
I'm going to exercise my Fifth Amendment privilege and not tell you some of the things that have inadvertently gotten through airport security in my bags.
I think we'd like to know. Let us know.
I don't think we want to know. Knowing Bobby, I don't think anybody wants to know. Anyway, that's not true. So there's a bunch of stuff. What do you think that means to say personal privacy?
I don't see too hard an impact on individual privacy. These were, again, all specifically targetable exploits. These are not things that can be widely deployed. If you are a bad person from a U.S. intelligence standpoint, then sure, we're going to be trying to get into your stuff. But for Joe Random Citizen?
Yeah, it makes no sense, you know, to be concerned about these tools.
The manpower that's required to deploy these tools, and given what the internal bill rates are for black bag teams, this is not something that, unless you're Dr. Evil grade, is going to likely be deployed against you.
Yeah. And you probably already suspect that these tools are being deployed against you anyway, if you are one of these people that are being targeted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, privacy apps like that.
So one of the really interesting things is the CIA has basically given up on cracking the crypto in these products. They go for compromising the device before the content's encrypted. So that tells me that commercially available encryption software is good enough to annoy a organization with nation state level resources, and that it's easier to just pop the box that it's sitting on rather than break it in transit. One of the other things that on the crypto note is in a section on Tradecraft do's and don'ts, they warn against custom implementing any kind of cryptography. Use the stuff that's built into the OS, one, to avoid attribution, equation group, but also because it's good enough for the timescales and purposes that we're dealing with in intelligence ops, which to me says that we can trust that built-in crypto if we're handling key management in a sane and sensible manner.
Yeah, for your normal everyday work that you do and, you know, your personal life, that's good enough. I mean, for the types of stuff that you're trying to transmit every day.
So that said, these guys, all these encrypted messaging app suppliers came out and said our stuff is still solid. That doesn't mean that the average private citizen should feel like if they're using it, their communications are secure, right? Because you still have to, you still get a keyboard, you still have a whatever.
The device itself is not secure if it has ever left your hands, ever.
Well, even if it has.
Yeah.
Even if it hasn't, right?
Well, wasn't in your hands from the time of manufacturing to
Exactly. So. Did you see that recently? There's been a bunch of stuff that's crept in through the supply chain.
Well, that's been a problem. That's been a problem for years that we've known about, and particularly in the networking device infrastructure. Cisco has a huge problem with counterfeit equipment. And how easy is it to divert a shipment and plant your own custom firmware on it?
Yeah. forget about Cisco itself. Think about the chips that are on the boards that...
I mean, Cisco doesn't even make Cisco? their own stuff.
The supply chain is not their own stuff.
No one makes their own stuff. So, I'm pretty sure that there's bits and pieces hidden in the firmware of just about everything from the Ministry of State Security or whatever they're calling themselves this month.
So, all right. So, speaking of state security, what do you think this means to our national security or national securities around the globe? Anything?
I don't really think it has that much of an effect on our security. I mean, this is one dump of probably data that, we don't know exactly how old this data is, but this could be pretty old and, likely there's more tools in the works, but I mean, the only effect it's really going to have is a little bit of time for things to be retooled, people to be retrained, operations put on hold until the new tools have been, developed and come back around. So could be a couple of months, it could be a couple of weeks. We don't know, really.
There's evidence that they're using fairly agile methodologies for the software engineering within the programs that were included in the dump. So I would suspect that most of them have already shifted payloads, and not recycling the same payload is one of the tradecraft things that were hinted very strongly was a good idea. So they've probably already moved on from all of these bits and pieces that are documented in there, at least in specific implementations and specific exploits. And they're going to have a constant development pipeline for finding new zero days to leverage for these exploits. So that's not impacted. Some of the exploits are going to get burned. Okay, big deal. They're going to find more. It's not like magically because this leak happened, the entire software engineering field is going to get better at their jobs. We've been trying that for 30 plus years.
Yeah, and this is only, roughly, let's just say 9,000 documents, which sounds like a lot of documents, but this is the government. That's 9,000 documents. They're probably, I don't know, let's just say 10 times that, that weren't walked out of the building.
Yeah. One of the ironic things about that whole thing, though, which I noticed, which maybe, Willis, you can comment on, is the idea that the exploits themselves are not classified. So, and the reason for that is the law would require if you were a government official with access to this stuff and you released it into an unclassified environment, which you have to use this stuff, then you would be basically committing espionage, right? So, Willis, can you comment on that?
See, that's kind of a gray area, right? Because these are things, like you said, they're being released into the wild, which would be considered an unclassified environment, but the details behind these exploits would likely still be classified. Well, now the binaries themselves and the tools themselves, maybe not.
The deployed payloads are either going to automatically be non-classified or there's going to be specific exemptions from the security requirements for those particular tools that are granted on an operation-by-operation basis.
Correct. Correct. And that would be up to the project managers and
project manager. But what's classified?
Well, yeah.
It depends on what the original classification authority was, and that can be overridden by various levels of executive appointees all the way up to the guy sitting behind the Resolute desk at 1600.
Correct.
All right, fine. Okay, so we've talked about personal privacy, national security. How about corporate set of security concerns?
Corporate security concerns, they have the same concerns as the general public. So from this standpoint, if you are nation state controlled corporate environment or you're doing something that is in the interest of the national security of the United States, then yeah, you do have something to worry about. If not,
So I think it's a yin and a yang. Well, first of all, it doesn't have to be. You don't have to have the attention of a nation state, right? A lot of this tradecraft, other adversaries, criminal adversaries have as well.
Yeah.
So in that sense, there's more information out there, so maybe we're more likely to get exploited, but we also have more information we could protect against, right?
First rule of information warfare is if you can do it to them, they'll eventually be able to do it back to you.
Yeah.
So this is not a radical departure from what we've observed in the civilian space in terms of information warfare capability. It's better systematized. There's a lot more documentation and process surrounding it. It's built to be used in a robust fashion by non-technical users. To be perfectly honest, sophisticated cybercrime operations using these tactics already exist. So yeah, the secret sauce, as it were, is a collection of best practices that make sense and that those of us in the industry have known about and follow ourselves.
Yeah. And maybe if anything, this is a good wake-up call to blue teams in corporate environments to actually look into the tradecraft that, you know, was being used by the CIA and, you know, take the inverse of that to defend against it.
Yeah. One of the admonitions is on your communications traffic and beaconing to use variable size and not use specific timing. Because I know that from an incident response perspective, I've gone and run packet dumps through Fourier transforms to look for periodic transmissions. And that's one of the techniques that we leverage in our Network Insight product to detect threat actors. Just applying a little bit of variability to that makes it much more of a looking for a needle in a stack of needles rather than a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of traffic blends into your normal user behavior and makes it way harder to actually detect the actor in the network, especially if they're not operating on off-hour time scales.
And one of the other interesting things is there is a description of a high latency command and control backend that's deployed as a single PHP page to a compromised web server, and it just picks it up and then forwards on the communications payload. So, you know, a device hitting a particular web address isn't that suspicious unless it's doing it over and over again on a predictable time scale.
Yeah. Yeah, especially if it's using multiple pages from multiple servers on, maybe they don't actually use the same page twice and they're only using single page one time.
But depending on the scope of your observation, even something that this particular machine is hitting these particular URLs once and only once within the observed timeline, that's enough of an anomaly to potentially detect if you're retaining all of that data.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of data. There aren't many technologies and organizations that have the technical capacity and the wherewithal to actually perform that type of analysis. So it's effectively, unless it gets caught and something else draws attention to the device, you're not going to find it.
Yeah. Even the ones who have the resources to do that, those corporations or those entities are large enough to where the larger they get, the less they can actually store. So even having the resources to purchase that type of talent, that type of equipment to keep track of that type of stuff, you know, it just means you're getting larger and there's less you can actually keep track of.
So from the discussion, to net it out, I would say this is really interesting stuff and good for the media, but probably not a huge impact on national or personal or corporate security. Any specific recommendations on things you should be doing if you're, you know, a CISO or, you know, head of SecOps at a corporation with respect to this dump?
If I can touch it, it's not your device anymore.
That's kind of defeatist.
It may be defeatist, but it is the truth. You know, if we can see it, then likely we can touch it and we can knock it over.
So is there anything about, you don't have to be, you know, in terms of, if I think about good practice, deter, detect, remediate, or detect quickly, you know, deter what you can, detect quickly, figure out how you're going to remediate that effectively, go back and validate, that kind of NIST sort of framework. Is there anything along the lines of this is not going to change your world? Obviously, that's good practice, deter, detect, remediate, validate, what have you. Is there anything along the lines of you don't have to be the fastest guy, you just have to be, you know, to get away from the bear, you just have to be faster than the guy down the street?
Well,
is that valid?
Yeah, presenting a less soft target than your neighbor has always been a viable security strategy. Security isn't about absolute security. It's about making it enough of a pain in the backside that the attacker goes somewhere else.
Yeah, right. Make it enough of a pain that they go somewhere else, and also keeping an eye on what's hanging out there in the wind.
Yeah, from a new threat standpoint, there's not a lot going on here, although exposing that CIA has been specifically targeting IoT-type devices for implants should hopefully open up a couple of eyes out there that IoT is actually important to care about security, even though I don't think that anyone's going to take that to heart.
No, probably not. And probably most places don't even know what IoT things are hanging out there for somebody to knock over.
You see the dishwasher with the directory traversal vulnerability on its built-in web server?
Yeah, yeah.
Oops.
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 So, yeah. Anyway, so if there's nothing else, this might be a good place to close the podcast. I'd certainly like to thank Bobby and Willis for their time. And again, if you want to get more technical details on the research that we do at Core Labs, you can find that on coresecurity.com.